Hello, and welcome to the TLT Scale Up Insights series of podcasts with me, Nina Searle, and my co-host, Andrew Jennings. Andrew and I are partners in the fast growth team here at TLT. We are a cross-jurisdictional UK team helping rapidly scaling businesses to manage the legal challenges that come with growth. In each episode, we'll dive into key topics that you're going to be thinking about as you grow your business and what you really need to know from a legal perspective. We share our insights and advice on the issues that clients bring to us on a daily basis and discuss them with experts, both from inside and outside the firm, drawing on their experience and the advice that they have found most valuable. We aim to work with our clients throughout their journey, supporting them from scale to sale. So whatever your business goals, this series will give you the insights you need to help you stay on course and achieve them. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you have any questions about anything we discuss in the show, please do get in touch at scaleupinsights@tltsolicitors.com. Today, we're joined by our colleague, Emma Erskine-Fox, who's an associate in our data privacy and cybersecurity team. She specialises in technology contracts and data protection. Today's topic is all about the golden rules for data collection and storage. We all know how valuable data is to a growing business, but how should you set up the right systems and processes to get the best out of it whilst complying with the regulations? Welcome, Emma. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Would you like to start off by just telling us a bit more about you and about what you do day to day?
Sure, yes. So as you said, my name's Emma Erskine-Fox. I'm an associate in our privacy and cybersecurity team. So I spend my days advising clients across all of our sectors with a particular focus on financial services on all manner of data protection compliance issues. So I've got lots of experience of building GDPR compliance programs for clients of a range of different sizes, right through from startups to, you know, major institutions. And also, we help clients deal with things like data breaches, because they do happen, however hard you try for them not to happen, and also negotiating data processing arrangements, data sharing agreements, things like that.
So Emma, GDPR is probably a familiar acronym to most listeners, and there's been a lot of buzz and chatter about the new legislation over the last couple of years, and probably lots of confusion as well about what it means for scale-up businesses. Can you break it down a bit for us to start off with?
Yeah, sure. So I think you're right. I think it can feel like a very confusing area of law. There's lots to take in, lots to think about. And as you said, the GDPR, or the General Data Protection Regulation, to give it its full name, was a new piece of legislation that was introduced back in May 2018. But I think in some ways it's not maybe as new as people think it is. Actually, a lot of the kind of core principles and some of the key obligations existed in the previous law, which was the Data Protection Act of 1998. So, you know, those sorts of things have been around for over 20 years. It did introduce some new elements and some kind of increased rights for individuals and things like that. But some of those core principles, as I say, have been around for quite a while. The GDPR was introduced for a couple of reasons, really, primarily to sort of update the law, to take into account advances in new technology. You know, say the old law was over 20 years old, think how much technology has moved forward since then, but also with the aim of sort of harmonising data protection law across the EU as well.
So, Emma, you mentioned the key obligations, some of the same reiterated from previous legislation and some of them are new. Can you just summarise for our listeners what those key obligations are?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, broadly, what the GDPR does is require businesses that handle personal data to treat that personal data in accordance with certain principles. So, for example, there's a principle of transparency, which means that you have to tell individuals what you're doing with their personal data. You have to give them certain information about that. You also have to make sure that you've got what's called a lawful basis or a justification, really, for processing that personal data. And you have to make sure that you treat that personal data fairly. There are security obligations, so you have to take measures to keep personal data secure. You also have to limit personal data to only the personal data that you actually need to sort of fulfill the purposes for which you need that data. And you can't hold data indefinitely. And this is something that we see quite often where, you know, we ask businesses how long they hold data for. And they don't have a particular period. They just say, well, we just keep it for as long as we need it. And sometimes that does mean that it's kept indefinitely, but you do have to only retain it for as long as you actually need that personal data. There are also certain rights that individuals have over their personal data and certain rules if you're sharing personal data with third parties. And then one of the key principles that was something that was new in the GDPR is something called accountability. And that basically means that it's not enough necessarily to be compliant. You have to be able to demonstrate your compliance. And that's usually done by way of things like having policy frameworks in place and governance structures and, you know, employee training, etc. That often has a bit of a different flavour for smaller businesses who might not have very many employees, but that obligation still applies. So even as a small business, you do have to think about things like, you know, who's responsible in your organisation for data protection compliance? How are you getting messages across to your employees about what they have to do with personal data and what their obligations are, etc.?
I think that's a key point, actually, that you raised there, Emma, about small businesses and how it has a different flavour for small businesses. Are the obligations on businesses uniform no matter what size the businesses are, or is there any variance or leeway for smaller businesses?
So that's a really good point. Broadly, the obligations apply regardless of your size. There are some obligations that are kind of slightly dependent sometimes on your size. So for example, there's an obligation to keep records of the personal data that you're processing. That obligation doesn't apply to businesses that have fewer than 250 employees, but the exemption only applies if your processing is what they call not occasional. So actually, if you're a small business, but you're quite a data-rich business and your service offering is quite data-heavy, you know, if you're a fintech, if you're in the kind of health tech business, which you see a lot of small businesses in that kind of space, if you're processing a lot of data and that's really core to your business, then even that obligation still applies to you. So actually, where the size might come into play is more in the sort of enforcement action, and I suppose how favourably the Information Commissioner's Office, which is the regulator or the ICO, might view you. But the obligations, broadly speaking, will apply in the same way.
And in terms of that enforcement, Emma, I mean, there have been, I suppose, two things. One would be in the lead up to GDPR coming into force, a lot of the headlines were taken up as to the impact that potential fines could have and how they would be quantified. And then subsequently, now that GDPR is in place, about how the impact of that on some large companies that has sort of been in the press.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that one of the sort of big, really daunting things for a lot of businesses about the GDPR was this massive increase in the potential fines. So under the previous law, the ICO could only fine a business up to £500,000. You know, for a small business, that's still a lot. But for some of the big names you see, you know, that's a drop in the ocean. The GDPR increased that maximum level to the greater of 20 million euros or 4% of annual worldwide turnover. So that's a really, really significant jump. And because it is the greater of, it means that even if you're a small business, theoretically, there is still that possibility that you could be subject to a really significant fine. Now, you mentioned, Andrew, the kind of fines that we've seen since the GDPR came into effect. And there were two really notable ones last year. They've not actually been sort of confirmed as the final figures yet. But the ICO issued notices of intent to fine British Airways and Marriott. And those notices of intent were £180 million for BA and £99 million or thereabouts for Marriott. So really, really significant sums of money. So we have now got a little bit of an indication of where the ICO might be going with those fines. They're both being appealed at the moment, so we'll kind of see where the final figure lands, and I suspect it will come down. But you know, that does show that, you know, the regulators aren't afraid to levy those really significant sums of money.
And is there any sort of scale to that, Emma, or is it, you know, as soon as someone breaches the GDPR, people are looking at the highest fine possible?
There's definitely a scale. You know, that's very much a maximum figure. And, you know, the ICO will take into account things like your resources. You know, when they're looking at whether to fine you and if so, how much to fine you, they will look at what your business is and, you know, how much money you've got and how easy it is for you to comply with these obligations. I think there's definitely an element for, you know, companies like BA and Marriott that, you know, these are really massive household names that have the resources to do this right. And some of the mistakes that were made in those examples were arguably fairly basic mistakes that the ICO kind of doesn't expect people of that size to be making. I think if you can demonstrate that you have done what you can and somebody has, you know, got into your systems regardless, but you have still within your means done what is possible for you to protect that data, then the ICO is likely to take a much more favourable approach.
And I guess as an advisor, you know, the legislation's been in since May 2018. So we're sort of a year and a bit into the legislation and the new regime. I know there was a lot in the press, a lot of sort of media attention and probably a bit of scaremongering at the time. Certainly was well trailed. as things have started to bed down, what's your take on how businesses have coped actually with the changes and how everything is bedding down, people are getting used to it?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that definitely people are getting more and more used, as you say, to what the obligations mean. I think one of the things that we have definitely seen is a real uptick in awareness, both at a business level, but also an individual level. So things that we see people struggling with a lot of the time actually are kind of user perceptions of how their data is used, and that might not tally with what's actually going on. So I think one of the key things that we're sort of seeing businesses, particularly kind of at the smaller end of the scale now, is kind of trying to really get the messages across to people what you're doing with their data in a way that makes them trust what you're doing, because actually we're seeing that that can really kind of mitigate some of the risks around, you know, people complaining about things. If they trust you and if they trust you to handle their data safely, then they're much less likely to raise those sorts of issues. So we are sort of seeing that trust becoming almost as important as the kind of legal compliance side of things.
You talked about legal compliance there, and you also talked about, you know, the obligations and the context and the regulation that is the GDPR. It seems to me, as not a data lawyer, that there's a lot there and a lot for businesses to think about legally, and a lot of potentially policies and things like that that they need to work to get in place. Are you able to give our listeners a bit of a steer as to what they need to prioritize, and perhaps what's a nice to have, but maybe not as essential, or something that maybe they can do for themselves?
Sure. I think there's actually probably quite a lot that businesses can do themselves. You know, there's a lot of guidance out there. The ICO's website is a really, really good place to start for small businesses. They have guidance that is specifically aimed at SMEs, actually. So they are really conscious that, you know, businesses of that sort of size do need a little bit more help and a little bit more steer to be able to do things themselves. I think a really, really good place for small businesses to start is by looking at what we call data mapping and doing a data mapping exercise. And really, that's about thinking about what data are you actually collecting? And it feeds into this obligation that I mentioned earlier about having to keep records of your data processing. And it basically means that you have to set out, okay, well, you know, we're collecting these categories of personal data about our employees, for example. This is what we're doing with it. This is where it's stored. This is who we share it with. These are the reasons for that sharing. This is how long we keep it for. So it's really kind of setting out a lot of those obligations, or, you know, just in a spreadsheet, frankly. I mean, the ICO has got a template of these records on their website. So again, you can go on, you can find that template, you can look at the sort of information that goes into there. And actually, a lot of the obligations, the other obligations that we've talked about, really flow through from that data mapping and that record keeping. So privacy notices, for example, this obligation I was talking about with regard to transparency, a lot of the information you have to give to people comes from that data mapping. So if you've done that right, and if you've kind of put some real thought into that, then actually you can just pull a lot of that information through, put some headings in it. And it's something, you know, it's something that you can use to demonstrate to the ICO, look, we've thought about this. We know that this is an obligation, and here's what we've done.
Just wanted to take a step back, Emma, in relation to trust. You mentioned trust and about the impact that can have on customers. And I suppose if I was to sort of replay that back, the impact that it can have on customers, in that if they trust the organization, they could be less likely to be seeking to enforce a breach. For our listeners as sort of fast growth scale up companies, are there any distinctives you've seen that they could seek to emulate so as to build trust with their customer base and with their users, in order that they can try and put themselves in the best possible place that they can with their customers going forward?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because actually I was talking to a startup company recently about this idea, and actually they had asked us to draft a privacy notice for them, which we had done. You know, we'd done it in a way that we often do privacy notices. And actually the client sort of said, you know, there was some kind of language in there that felt quite sort of legalistic, even though to our minds it wasn't. You know, we always try and make these things as user-friendly as possible. But I think as lawyers, it's really easy to forget that somebody has to read this who isn't going to understand what you're talking about. And actually there were things, you know, even things like saying, which companies often have at the start of their privacy notices, you know, it's important to us that your data is kept safe. You know, there are just ways that you can word that really make it you know, feel as if data protection and protecting people's privacy is absolutely at the heart of what you do. So I think a lot of it is around that messaging and around the language that you use, and just really bearing in mind that, you know, the people who are engaging with this are likely to have quite a, you know, not as high maybe a level of understanding as we do. So it's just really important to be as clear as possible, as user-friendly as possible in those processes.
That's understandable. And I suppose, especially, as you say, if we are putting forward legal documentation or notices that need to communicate key legal points about how a business operates, for us to be able to craft those in a way that has that integrity of brand and of messaging, of communication of the relevant company, in order that everything that they put out is completely them and, yeah, and that they're happy with.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the most interesting pieces of work I've ever done in this space is actually drafting a privacy notice aimed at children, and turning, it was a product that was aimed, it could be aimed at adults or children. And so we had a normal privacy notice, an adult one in inverted commas, and then we turned that into one that was aimed at children. And it really makes you think about what you're saying and how you're saying it. And, you know, again, I was talking to a colleague recently who has a client, and their sort of bar for whether their privacy notices are sufficiently easy to understand is the average, I think it's something like, you know, the average level of intelligence of a 10-year-old. So it just demonstrates the need to kind of really think those things through, and obviously kind of keep it in line with what you need to do legally. But there are, interestingly, there are specific legal obligations in the GDPR to make your privacy notices easy to understand and in clear and plain language.
One of the things, Nina, I thought maybe from our perspective as corporate lawyers, one of the themes that's been coming through a number of the podcasts has been around, say, the relationship with investors, and now talking about relationship with customers, and how your company ethos is communicated to those that it needs to be communicated to, and the impact that can have. And I suppose just thinking with our sort of corporate hat on about the impact of that and whether that's of importance to our listeners.
Well, I think from a corporate perspective, obviously we don't get so involved in the nitty-gritty of the data legislation and the rules and regulations about collecting it and storing it, but it still impacts on what we and our corporate clients think about and the way they react, because everybody is so aware of it these days. And I don't just mean on the company side, but people in the street know that they've got data and that they've got rights that surround that data. They don't necessarily fully understand what they are, but it doesn't stop them making a subject access request or other things. So I think there's a few elements from my perspective to it, which, you know, one of them is about the customer relationship, the user experience and that trust, because that goes beyond just the impact that the regulator might enforce against you. But if your value is your customer relationships and you lose them because there's been a breach of trust, then in a way that's much more damaging and much more difficult to recover from than a proportionate fine from the ICO. And that's something that investor clients are going to be looking at when they're looking at these companies, thinking of investing in them. Are they compliant? Are they aware of their needs to be compliant and taking advice where they need to? Have they got policies in place? And to be honest, you can just Google somebody and have a pretty clear idea of whether they've got the right idea about their policies, because they should be popping up for you to see. So it's very evident now where people should be taking action and not taking action. So
definitely,
I think investors, it's one of the things they're going to be looking at in the round about how well run is this company, how investable is this team.
Yeah. And again, I think a lot of that really is about showing that you've done what you can. You know, it's not about necessarily everything being word perfect and, you know, being, you wouldn't expect a startup to have a privacy notice that looks the same as a massive bank, because, as I say, you just don't have that resource. But if you can make it clear that that is at the heart of your ethos and that you have really thought about how you can protect people and protect people's rights, that is really helpful, both from a regulatory perspective, but also, as you say, from a wider reputational point of view and when you're engaging with investors.
I think the other thing we see where data interplays with corporate transactions and particularly investments is with data rooms. So where an investor or potentially a purchaser, if you're at the sale end of the scale, are collecting the due diligence information about you and your business and the company that they need to assess whether it's something that they want to buy into and whether it's worth what they're proposing to pay for it. These days, data is all collected up and put in an electronic data room. And there's often some questions that need to be considered about the data that's put in there and whether that's personal data. And if it is, obviously it wasn't collected for the purposes of putting it in a data room to be reviewed by a potential purchaser or investor. So the people whose data it is haven't provided consent to that. And so there are some challenges about how we administer that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we see in our team a few questions often coming through from you guys on this point. And I think the classic example is employee information. You know, for employees that are transferring over, you know, there'll be a set of information that needs to go into that data room so that the buyer can assess that. And actually, really, what this comes down to is what we call data minimization, which is a principle that I mentioned briefly earlier, which means that you can't collect too much data and you can't process and share too much data. You have to limit what you're processing to the minimum that's required to fulfill the purpose of the processing. So with employee information, for example, in a data room, you know, when you think about the purpose of that information going in, as you said, that is for the buyer to assess the, you know, whether they want to buy this company, you know, to assess the liabilities, to assess which employees are going to come over and look at their salaries and things like that. And actually, to fulfill that purpose, they don't need to know who those employees are a lot of the time up until, you know, at a certain point in the transaction, then arguably, yes, they will need to know that. But certainly at those initial stages when things are just being uploaded to the data room, that's how you should be thinking about it. Does the buyer, does the investor need to know this data in order for the purposes to be fulfilled? And I think it's interesting that you mentioned consent, because actually I think there is sometimes a misconception that you always need consent to do these things. You always need consent to share personal data. And that's not always the case. If you have been able to be transparent with people about how you're processing your data, so if you do get to a certain point in the transaction where employees are now aware of the transaction, it's within their reasonable expectations then that the buyer or the investor will need to know who they are, and you've got a clear legitimate reason at that point to then share that data. So you don't then necessarily at that point need to get consent, because it's something that the employees would be aware of, and as I say, you've got a justification for doing it.
And Emma, what are some of the other key things that scale-up businesses need to have in place to demonstrate GDPR compliance?
So I think one of the things that sometimes gets a bit overlooked is thinking about whether you need a data protection officer. And this is something that you see quite a lot. It's abbreviated DPO a lot of the time. And there are statutory obligations to have a DPO, again, regardless of your size, in certain circumstances. So for example, if you're carrying out large-scale processing of what we call special category personal data, that was known as sensitive personal data under the previous law, which might be a bit more of a familiar term. But things like health data, things like data about race and religion and sexual orientation, all sorts of things like that. So again, you can see some smaller companies in the sort of med tech, health tech spaces might fall into that category. And if you're processing that data on a large scale, then you need to have a data protection officer in place. And that means that that DPO has to have appropriate expertise. So it can't just be anybody. So again, we see this quite a lot where we tell people they need a DPO and they go, oh, well, I'll do it. That's, you know, I'll take on that role. But actually, it does need to be somebody with data protection expertise. So you do need to put a bit of thought into who that is and not kind of make a, you know, a bit more of an arbitrary appointment.
When you say expertise, Emma, how expert do we have to be? Because a lot of people will be listening thinking, well, I haven't got the budget to appoint a data protection specialist. And actually, what would they do for 6 of the 7 hours a day?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point and definitely right. There isn't a kind of, you know, a set sort of level of expertise. And actually, it doesn't have to be somebody internal. So we act as a firm for as a sort of external DPO for some of our clients. And actually, that might be a good solution, you know, as you say, for businesses that aren't going to need necessarily somebody on the ground all the time, you know, to set up an arrangement, a sort of, you know, some sort of retainer arrangement with somebody external, where you can, you know, be a bit more flexible with your budget. Then that is, you know, as valid an option as having somebody internal as well.
And Emma, what if things do go wrong? I'm sure that our listeners, when hearing about the fines that are at risk in relation to their turnover and so on, that if they were to get a call or a late night email saying about a potential breach, that could be a real crisis point for a company. What would your advice be in that situation?
So I think there's a kind of proactive and a reactive element to this. I think proactively, you need to be planning for these sorts of circumstances. As you said, you know, however well you manage your data, there's always a hacker somewhere who's one step ahead of you and who could get into your system. So it's really important to think about, if this did happen, who would be in charge of dealing with it? Which people would we need on the ground to be managing this? And also kind of taking even a step further back from that, how are your employees going to be aware that a data breach has occurred? Because actually, you know, people think of a data breach as being, you know, a hack, and that's the obvious one, but actually it can take many forms. You know, it could be your systems crashing and losing loads of data. It could be theft of data. You know, we're increasingly seeing clients struggling with kind of rogue employees being a bit unhappy and running off with a bunch of data. You know, it can be things like sending an email to the wrong person with personal data. And, you know, we've seen that happen with big salary spreadsheets before, where they've gone to somebody in the business who's got a similar name, and it's, you know, fallen foul of the autofill function on your email. So it can take many, many forms. So you really need to make sure that your employees know that if something particular happens, that is a data breach, and they need to be telling you about it so that you can mobilize the right people. And then, yeah, once that call does come in, the reactive approach then is just act as quickly as you can, get all those people together. There are certain circumstances, if a breach poses a risk to individuals, you have to notify the ICO about that breach. And that notification has to go in within 72 hours of the business becoming aware of it. And that's not when you become aware of it as an individual, that's when anybody within the business has become aware of that breach. So you've got to act really, really quickly. There's a bunch of other information that you need to give the ICO about the breach, about how it's happened and what you're doing to mitigate it, etc. So your first step should always be, you know, get the right people involved, get everybody on a call, talk about what has happened, start doing what you can to mitigate it. You know, if it is an email that's gone to the wrong person, can you recall that email, etc., etc. So thinking about all those things at the same time, and then possibly getting your notification in.
And Emma, you mentioned earlier the fines that have been levied on well-known brands by the ICO. And I believe those were all related to security breaches by those companies along the lines that you've just been talking about. I wonder what smaller businesses, scaling businesses who are working with limited resources can do to avoid falling foul of these problems.
Sure. So I think what's important to note from the start is that the obligations around security talk about taking appropriate technical and organizational measures to protect personal data. And what's appropriate will depend on a lot of things, you know, the nature of the data and the risk that could result to the individual if that data was compromised. But it does also talk about taking into account the costs of implementation. So that's important for scale-up businesses to be aware of, that there is a kind of cost element to that assessment of what is going to be appropriate to protect their personal data. So you can think about that. I think some of the things that, you know, we see people falling foul of are really things that the ICO sees as quite basic security measures that aren't always particularly high cost, you know, encryption solutions and things like that. But also some of the things that I've mentioned about, you know, making sure that data isn't, you know, sent to the wrong person or left on trains, things like that. Those are the sorts of things that it's, you know, it should be fairly straightforward to drum those sorts of things into your employees and make sure that they are thinking about those. You know, you don't necessarily need the kind of, you know, really top state-of-the-art security measures that, as I say, a massive institution is going to have. But a lot of it's about kind of taking common sense approaches to security.
And I guess, you know, harbouring a culture where employees tell you if they have messed up, because people Definitely. Are humans. Employees, well, we all are going to make mistakes at some point in time.
Yeah.
And so if you've got a culture where people feel able to come straight to you and say, I've sent an email to the wrong place, I've tried to recall it, I'm letting you know, is much better than a culture where employees try to cover it up or sweep it under the carpet.
Definitely. And actually often, certainly reputationally, you know, the magic is in how you respond to these things. I think there's definitely an appreciation that these things can happen. And, you know, human error is a big thing, you know, and as long as you respond to it appropriately, then actually that kind of mitigates a lot of the risks. So you're absolutely right. You need to know about these sorts of things. You need employees to be able to come to you without worrying that they're automatically going to be fired for it.
And I expect with that, Emma, that there's obviously a good way and a bad way to respond. Have you seen some sort of good examples of good practice and how people have responded to data breaches?
Yeah, I think good practice is, there are many ways that you can do this well. The best practice for me is being more proactive about these things. And actually, we're seeing more and more clients actually looking at doing data breach rehearsals. So data breach incident rehearsals. So they actually, you know, go through a kind of practice scenario almost. And so they get used to mobilizing the right people and things, you know, all those sorts of things that I've talked about. Those are the sorts of things that we see as being really good practice. You know, where it's not so good is really where, yeah, it's not, the right people haven't been told. We see a lot of problems with you know, when we're helping clients out with these sort of breach notifications to the ICO, probably the main issue that we see is just that we can't get the right information because, you know, somebody who was meant to be on the call has, you know, been called away to do something else. So I think, again, it's about building into the culture of your business an appreciation for how important these sorts of issues are so that all those people know that if that happens, you know, they have to drop things, they have to be straight on that call, and they have to be working to put things right.
I suppose with many of our clients, Emma, fast-moving, fast-paced, scale-up businesses, they may be saying, look, I don't have budget for all of this. What's the most pragmatic way to approach data collection and storage for scale-up businesses so as to keep on the right side of GDPR but not costing them a complete fortune?
Yeah, sure. I would say make the most of the ICO resources. As I said earlier, there's a lot of ICO guidance out there, an increasing amount now that we're, as you say, nearly 2 years on from GDPR. And they also have a lot of templates as well, you know, templates for things like the data processing records that I talked about and special resources for SMEs. So always go and look at those. Never rely on what you see in the press because there's been a lot of misreporting about the GDPR. So, you know, don't necessarily take what you see as read, which is probably a good motto for life generally. A lot of it is quite common sense and a lot of it is based on kind of ethical principles. So, you know, if you're thinking about things like, how would I feel if this was my data? What sort of things would I want this company to be doing if we were if it was processing my data? Things like that can really help you to just sort of take a step back and think about it from a slightly more pragmatic point of view. We actually, as a team, we've sort of anticipated some of our smaller clients' needs on this front, and we've actually put together what we call a GDPR DIY toolkit. And that is basically a set of templates that we sell at a fixed price for each template. It comes with a little bit of advice to go alongside that, but not any sort of bespoking. So we've deliberately put that together as a low cost option for clients to, you know, take something where they've got the bones of it, they can input their own information into that to make it bespoke to them, but without having to spend tons and tons of money on us sort of making that more bespoke for them. So looking into options like that is always a good idea as well.
So, I mean, we've talked a lot about data handling and GDPR, but if there was one key takeaway from today's podcast for our listeners, what would it be?
I think it would be know your data. I think most of the issues, or certainly many of the issues that we see, and this is again from clients of all shapes and sizes really, is they don't actually know what data they've got or what's being done with it or where it's being stored, who's got access to it, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we've talked a bit about the sort of data mapping and record keeping obligations. And I think, you know, if you can do that, if you know what data you've got, you're in a really, really good position then to start putting together all those policies and those frameworks and things like that. And that feeds through into a lot of those documents that you need to be able to demonstrate compliance.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great talking to you about data, and I'm sure you've given a lot of our listeners some really practical things to go away and put into practice straight away in their businesses. So thank you so much for your time.
Very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Scale Up Insight podcast. If you have any questions about anything we discussed in the show, please get in touch at scaleupinsights@trtsolicitors.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please rate us and leave us a review on your podcast app. It means that more people can find us and take a listen. The information in this podcast is for general guidance and represents our understanding of the relevant law and practice at the time of recording. We recommend you seek advice in specific cases. Please visit our website for our full terms and conditions.